A committee of Princeton University trustees is considering whether to remove President Woodrow Wilson's name from one of its colleges and the School of Public and International Affairs. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The move comes in response to a recent backlash against Wilson, who some view as racist for his policies and attitudes. Wilson was also president of Princeton University. WHYY's Joe Hernandez stopped by one of the committee's public meetings last week and offers this report.
Joanna Anyanwu is one of the students calling for the removal of Wilson's name. Anyanwu, who is black, has spent 5 years in the renowned Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs, four as an undergrad and one as a graduate student.
I have no other choice because that is my major, that is my concentration. So what we're saying is that this notion of prestige is far more important than the experiences of the students who currently inhabit those spaces and don't have a choice of leaving those spaces.
Also at the meeting, a lot of Princeton alumni. Harvey Rothberg, who graduated in 1949, says Wilson's name should stay, but the school should install a plaque detailing the former president's achievements as well as his shortcomings.
It's essential that all students, black, white, alumni, visitors, should be aware of who Wilson was and what he did and his accomplishments, mostly good and occasionally not so good.
Others questioned whether the debate over Wilson's name is a superficial issue that doesn't address actual race problems on campus. Senior Brandon Scott invoked Greek mythology in suggesting that Princeton use this opportunity to redefine itself as a more inclusive institution.
And so in that sense, when I think about this idea of renaming the Wilson School or renaming the college, it almost seems like, you know, chopping off one of the hydra's heads in a way, that chop it off and it'll grow right back. And so I do see it largely more as an opportunity to sort of reimagine what Princeton could be.
The committee hopes to issue its recommendations in the spring. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Passengers of the ride-hailing service Uber may notice something different about trips in Philadelphia. The driver may make a few stops before arriving at their destination. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, Uber's new carpooling service is catching some by surprise.
Nearly 2 weeks ago, Uber launched Uber Pool in Philly. And here's an Uber driver describing the new feature.
You'll request an Uber Pool, and we'll pick up a rider that's taking a similar route, and you guys will basically split the fare for the Uber ride.
That's Andrew, who didn't want to give his last name. He says when someone uses the Uber app now, two options automatically show up. One showing the price of a regular Uber X ride, and then the lower cost of an Uber Pool ride. Uber passenger Maria Zeeb says that makes the decision easy.
Yeah, it was the first option that came up, you know, looked cheaper than the other one, so I figured why not.
But not everyone is embracing the new feature. You have to opt out of the carpooling option, so if you're not paying attention, you might find yourself sharing a backseat with others accidentally, and maybe making other stops before yours. That has annoyed some passengers, and as Uber driver Adam Ben-Hodger says, not all drivers are on board.
Probably, you know, they don't want to waste time because picking up this guy, and they go the second one, pick him up, and they'll go the third one, pick him up, then drop the first one, then go pick up another one.
And multiple stops on the same route doesn't mean more money for drivers. Meanwhile, the Philadelphia Parking Authority's attorney, Dennis Weldon, says Uber is still unregulated by the city, and therefore illegal. What does he make of Uber Pool?
Basically kind of turns into a bus service, right? I mean, it starts to look like a bunch of people that don't know each other getting in the vehicle at different places.
In New York City, some are capitalizing on the random selection of carpooling. The New York Post calls Uber Pool the best new blind date spot. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Even before the fight erupted over when to replace deceased U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, President Barack Obama and Republicans in Congress were squaring off on the nation's spending priorities. But Republicans from our region are also divided over how to handle it, as WHYY's Matt Laszlo reports.
Every year here in Washington, the White House and lawmakers in Congress do a strange dance. Feel free to think of it as the budget tango. Like all things policy-oriented, it's not sexy. But there are precise choreographed movements, with the White House always taking the lead. This year, Republicans decided there would be no dance. GOP leaders upended decades of congressional protocol and refused to even invite Obama administration officials to the Capitol to discuss their budget numbers. Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey, one of the Republicans on the budget committee, is fine with the move.
It's certainly not a serious document. And in past years, when we've put it to a vote, every Democrat's voted against it. How serious could it possibly be?
Toomey is facing tough re-election prospects this year. He says there's no way Republicans like him were going to support the president's $4.1 trillion budget.
You know, huge spending increases, huge tax increases. That's what's given us this. It's a big part of what's given us this really, really weak economy for year after year.
Delaware Democratic Senator Chris Coons says it's a sad day in Washington when the GOP won't even debate the White House over competing spending priorities.
I'm struck that neither the House or the Senate Budget Committee chairs have agreed to have the director of OMB come and present the budget. They can label it a political document, but it is the president's budget, and a huge amount of work went into it. I think, at the very least, it should be given a fair hearing because there are some compelling policy ideas in it.
The GOP is facing its own internal party squabble over the budget. A small but powerful group of House Republicans are trying to slash the budget numbers already agreed to by congressional Republicans and the Democratic White House. The Tea Party-inspired House Freedom Caucus is dead set on slashing the current budget agreement by $30 billion, even though that could derail the GOP's chances of even passing a budget this year. New Jersey Republican Thomas MacArthur says it's foolish for his party to go back on the spending levels agreed to last year.
The ink's not even dry on it, and my belief is it would be a mistake to crack that open. So there's a lot of competing pressures. I know there's a lot of pressure on the budget committee to try to reconcile all of them, but my personal belief is we ought to stick to our guns.
Think of a budget as a roadmap. It lays out the broad spending caps, while people on the appropriations or spending committee are actually in control of driving the car. Philadelphia Democratic Congressman Chaka Fattah gets to help drive from his seat on the committee. He says the GOP needs to figure out spending levels soon, or else it will cause confusion at home.
You know, in Philadelphia, we provide about $300 million a year for early childhood education. The mayor and the governor want to increase access to pre-K. The federal government can be a partner, but we need to get our bills done on time so that we can work with local officials on getting these things done.
This year's proposed budget has items that are easy for the public to care about. It calls for a focused effort to eradicate cancer, led by Vice President Joe Biden. It also seeks to double down on efforts to boost the renewable energy sector, as it would impose a new $10 per barrel tax on oil. Republicans don't like that last one, or many of the other new initiatives. However, Pennsylvania Republican Pat Meehan is looking for common ground.
So, I mean, there's things we can work, not just on the margins, but probably where we have shared aspirations for people who are trying to find a way forward. But in the end, we've got to be able to do it so that we are paying attention to, you know, not just the right priorities, but the long-term implications of the debt.
Meehan points to one spot in particular where he thinks the two parties may be able to overcome election year morass, making college more affordable.
Say, take a Pell Grant and not have it count against your income so that when you, at the end of the year, are trying to calculate where you're going to find the last $25 for a tuition payment, make a difference.
This is an election year. While neither party is likely to check off many items on their competing wish list, the competing budget priorities will provide lots of grist for the campaign trail. For WHYY News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, Pennsylvania House Democrats are questioning the wisdom of trying to impeach State Attorney General Kathleen Kane now that she's no longer seeking the party's nod for another term in office. They've asked whether it's possible to mount an impeachment process before Kane's criminal charges are resolved. Her trial is set for August. Her term is up in January. Democrats raised the concerns during the first meeting of a House subcommittee that's tasked with making a recommendation on whether Kane committed impeachable offenses. Two families who accuse one of the largest natural gas drillers in Pennsylvania of polluting their well water are getting their day in court. Opening statements were delivered today in a federal lawsuit pitting homeowners in the village of Dimock against Houston-based Cabot Oil and Gas. Dozens of other plaintiffs settled with Cabot in 2012. Dimock was the scene of the most highly publicized case of methane contamination to emerge from Pennsylvania's natural gas drilling boom. State regulators blamed faulty gas wells drilled by Cabot for leaking combustible methane into Dimock's groundwater. The company denies responsibility. The town's plight was featured in the 2010 documentary Gasland. 40 degrees at 6:14. You are listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. Anticipate periods of rain this evening, overnight low 37 degrees. A rainy day tomorrow, warmer Wednesday's high 56. Thursday, still cloudy. There's a 30% chance of stray showers, high again in the mid-50s. Sunny days, Friday and Saturday, high both days around 42. Sunday, mostly sunny, high 55 degrees. It's 6:15. This is WHYY. Still ahead, a new museum exhibit follows the spread of pop art, from the comic book and advertising images of American artists to the political statements depicted by artists in other countries.
The spread of culture is something that's felt throughout the world from this kind of nexus of America, but it's not always celebrated.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
The quick rise in rooftop solar systems has done a number on the utility industry.
In the long term, rooftop solar is a pretty disruptive threat to the utility business model.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Right now, in a galaxy really, really close, the Solar Wars. That's next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Newman University supports WHYY and encourages listeners to discover how a master's degree in pastoral clinical mental health counseling can help prepare adults for professional licensure and roles in community counseling. Designed to integrate psychology and spirituality, this ecumenical program is open to people of all faith traditions. There's an information session on March 8th at Newman's campus. Details at newman.edu.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Although data can be a powerful tool in the argument over policies to address gun violence, approaches to collecting and using information across local police departments are inconsistent. For Keystone Crossroads, Rachel McDevitt reports.
Call around to a few police departments in Pennsylvania to ask about gun crime, and you're bound to get a lot of different kinds of statistics.
We recovered 133 firearms off the streets in 2012.
Chief Randy Bowers of the Erie Police Department says getting guns off the streets is one of the best ways to prevent firearm crime. The Philadelphia Police Department releases annual reports on its website that show the number of shooting victims and homicide by firearm. And in Reading, they're watching where the verified shots fired reports are in the city. Each police force is putting out the information they think gives the best picture of what's going on in their respective communities. The only place for big-picture data on crime in the United States is the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting System, or UCR. But some say it's not the best system because each state and municipality has its own standards for reporting crimes. In Lancaster, Lieutenant Todd Umstead started keeping a running total on a notepad by his desk of the number of people actually hurt in shootings, because that wasn't clear just by looking at the UCR.
If someone shoots a gun towards a car that has four occupants in a car and nobody's hit, nobody's injured, that counts as four aggravated assault firearms. I don't really consider that a shooting. I don't think the average person would consider that a shooting because no one was actually shot.
The Pennsylvania State Police UCR may give a better picture for the Commonwealth. You can search it online by department and offense and see how many assaults, robberies, and homicides were committed with firearms. But only a small fraction of departments in PA are using the more specific incident-based reporting with 46 categories of crime, as opposed to summary-based with only 8 categories. So it's hard to compare municipalities. Dane Merriman with the Pennsylvania Chiefs of Police Association says because of budget tightening, a lot of smaller departments just don't have the capability to do more than the minimum required by the UCR.
It is always going to be a funding issue for departments to, you know, replace existing systems and upgrade their data capabilities. So it's going to be a long-term process.
Police in the city of Harrisburg are more than familiar with budget challenges. They saw a drawdown of officers before the city entered the state's Act 47 program for distressed communities in 2010. Fewer officers creates a need to police smarter, says Captain Gabriel Oliveira. So, with a grant from the Dauphin County District Attorney's Office, they were able to launch a new records management system in November. The old one was over 20 years old and cumbersome. Oliveira had to manually count the firearm offenses over the last year. Harrisburg officers are still learning how to use the new system, but Oliveira says when the training period is over, the clearer data will help them form a new plan to reduce crime.
Being able to put it in a mapping system, we may see something a little bit different than what we already know. We may know that in a specific areas, there may be quite a few robberies, but when you put it in a map, that may actually show a pattern.
But some people have doubts the clearer numbers will actually make a difference. Jeremy Domenico and his wife Janine are block captains on their street in South Allison Hill in Harrisburg, and they say a lot of crime there goes unreported.
Our neighbor across the street had a shotgun pulled on him. He's not reporting that. The people behind us had a pistol pulled on them. He's not reporting that.
The Domenicos say police officers could reduce crime if they could find a way to build trust in the community again, but that might be even more complicated than upgrading our record system. For Keystone Crossroads, I'm Rachel McDevitt.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the four-station partnership. The presidential candidate campaign sprint is in full gear ahead of Super Tuesday, March 1st. That's when Democrats Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders vie for support in 10 states holding primaries. Before looking ahead, let's take a moment to consider Sanders' historic victory back on February 9th in New Hampshire with Jonathan Zimmerman. He teaches history at New York University. Jonathan, welcome back to Newsworks Tonight.
Good to be here as always.
What's historic about Bernie's victory?
Well, what's historic about Bernie's victory in New Hampshire is that the first primary victory by a Jewish American in a presidential election.
Not the first time somebody who's Jewish has run.
Well, that's true. I remember that Joe Lieberman ran for vice president in 2000 and then ran for president in 2004, but he never won a primary. It's also worth noting that Barry Goldwater was born to a Jewish father and an Episcopalian mother, but was raised Christian, didn't self-identify as Jewish, which is why Harry Golden famously said that he knew that the first Jewish American president would be Episcopalian.
Though Joe Lieberman certainly ran on his heritage, I believe he was Orthodox, and it was already known that he would be cutting back on whatever work duties were required of him on the Sabbath.
Saturday. Oh, absolutely. No, he was extremely clear about his identity, but he was not successful as a presidential candidate. What's historic about Bernie's victory in New Hampshire, again, it's the first time a Jewish American has won a presidential primary.
To try to get a sense of where Bernie Sanders stands on his heritage, his religion, he was asked that question recently on a Jimmy Kimmel show. Let's give a listen.
You say you're culturally Jewish. You don't feel religious. Do you believe in God, and do you think that's important to the people of the United States?
I am who I am, and what I believe in and what my spirituality is about is that we're all in this together.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, Sanders gave, I thought, a very eloquent statement of his faith and faith system, but he didn't reference the fact that he's Jewish, even though, of course, his parents were Jewish. He was bar mitzvahed, went to Israel to work in a kibbutz in his youth and so on.
Perhaps he's casting his net wider. The largest group, not religious, of course, but within the category of religion, spirituality, is the rise of secularism. And it's appealing, I'm sure, to many of those who voted for him in New Hampshire, white, liberal, and young.
Yeah, possibly so. And I also think it's fair to say that many people, including many people I've spoken to in recent days, neither knew nor cared that Bernie Sanders is Jewish. And as a historian, I find that absolutely remarkable, given the kind of prejudice that Jews have encountered in the political sphere over hard time.
Understandable that they might not have known, since, as we've been discussing, he hasn't played it off. But to what extent do you really feel that they don't care?
I can't say that voters don't care yet. What I do think is interesting, however, is that nobody's made an issue of this. Part of that is because Sanders, of course, himself doesn't play up his Judaism, the fact that he would be the first Jewish president. And it's quite different, say, from Hillary Clinton, who is very explicit about the fact in her pitch that she would be the first female president. But I also think historically it's remarkable that there hasn't been a great deal of discussion about this subject, because in earlier eras, whether Sanders played up his Judaism or not, Americans absolutely would have.
But to what extent is past prologue? Many pundits are saying this is like no other presidential election season. Maureen Dowd this past Sunday wrote, "The country is now aflame with anger and disgust about politicians and bankers who conned trusting Americans and never got punished for it. That fury has led to the rise of wildly improbable candidates in both parties, thereby linking similar energies that draw one to Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders."
Well, look, if you survey Americans now and you ask them a question like, would you vote for a Jewish person for president? Over 90% of people respond affirmatively. But that, too, is a function of our time, because if you go back even to the New Deal in the 1930s, only 46% of Americans said they would. Now, it's an open question how honest people are in polls like this. It turns out that prejudice is an extremely difficult thing to measure because people know the right answer. And they're not willing to admit their own prejudices. So if Sanders did become the nominee, we would find out for sure whether people are willing to vote for a Jew. They say they are, but I think the proof will be in the pudding.
Jonathan Zimmerman joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Thanks. It was fun.
Tomorrow, the Philadelphia Museum of Art will open an exhibit of pop art, which will include many of the touchstone artists of that mid-century movement, like Andy Warhol and Jasper Johns. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that International Pop is a show about how the art movement changed as it traveled around the world.
Pop art started in America and Great Britain as artists appropriated comics, advertising, and vibrant color to make work that flattened high art with conspicuous consumption. A first stab at a definition came in 1957 when the English artist Richard Hamilton said pop art is popular, transient, expendable, low-cost, mass-produced, young, witty, sexy. It was a movement of its time, but Erica Battle, an associate curator at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, says pop was not always pop.
Even in the United States, it was called New Realism at first. In Paris, the Nouveau Realists came together on similar ideas. Artists in Germany called themselves the Capitalist Realists and rejected the name pop. They didn't want to seem like they were just importing an American idea. Artists in Brazil rejected the idea of American pop because America was kind of complicit in a military dictatorship at the time. And so pop had many kind of local vernaculars.
In some countries, pop art was one of the only ways artists could comment on violence and censorship. Artists in Brazil used pop to describe political oppression. In Japan, where America still had a military presence, it was a mishmash of American comic books and Japanese woodcut prints.
America's this rising superpower, but it's not always embraced. There's an element of critique, contrast, of rejection. The spread of culture is something that's felt throughout the world from this kind of nexus of America, but it's not always celebrated.
In accordance with that original definition, the show includes plenty of work that is young, witty, and sexy, including manipulated Italian movie posters for Marilyn Monroe and lushly painted canvases of brightly colored cake. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Finally this evening, Harry J. Katz, a gadfly on Philadelphia's celebrity scene in the 1970s and 80s, died today at the age of 75. Independently wealthy, he used his affluence to fund a lavish lifestyle and pursue a variety of ventures, many of which were short-lived. Katz was publisher of Electricity, an early weekly newspaper in Philadelphia. In 1974, he dabbled in professional sports, buying the fledgling World Football League's Philadelphia Bell, only to sell the team after a few months. One of his great accomplishments was reopening the Erlanger Theater in Center City in the late 1960s for a few years as a nightclub, cafe, and theater. Perhaps his biggest failure, a plan to open a Playboy Club on Broad Street in Center City, which was blocked by then-Police Commissioner Frank Rizzo. Well, considering the public's current appetite for celebrities who are famous for just being famous, Harry J. Katz was, in a sense, ahead of his time. We're out of time. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, we'll hear from Bruce Graham, writer of the new play Funny Man, now playing in Philadelphia. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.